Good evening, brothers and sisters in the Dharma. Now, today's talk will be remembering past life by Ajahn Brahmawangsa. Kindly sit, relax, and listen to the enlightened talk tonight. Thank you.
So it's lovely to see so many people reincarnated here again, especially the ghosts and the devas in the higher seats. Today's talk is about remembering past lives. I'm not sure if you've read a recent story from the United States of a 15-year-old boy who's already composed his 7th symphony and had his music played in Carnegie Hall. It had been played by the great Berlin Philharmonic. A person who, when he was 3 years old, asked for his birthday present to have a cello. And a boy who was composing at such a young age and had so much of his music examined by the best musicians of his day. And it's not kids' music. It's fine, grown-up, very profound music. And he's just had his 15th birthday and is on his 7th symphony. A modern day Mozart. A person who has such skills that there's no way they could have been learned in this one life. And the obvious, only rational explanation is not that he learned how to play a cello at 3 or could compose symphonies. You can't learn that in this life, not by the age of 15, to be on his 7th symphony. One can only learn that, or have that ability, by recalling something from your previous life. And there are so many other stories about people who have either innate abilities, who have great achievements in this life, things which cannot be explained by the teaching and learning of one life alone. And the reason I give this talk is not just to interest people, but because this has a huge impact on people's understanding of life itself. If only we could understand that we have lived before, that we will live again after death. If only our leaders could accept the truth of reincarnation, then our leaders will take much better care of this planet. If Mr. Bush knew he was going to come back again, he'd sign up Kyoto Protocol straight away. Because he wouldn't want to live in a world which was afflicted by global warming. But the problem is, many of us think, oh, by the time that happens, we'd be dead, we'd be gone, we'd be out of here. But if you know you will have to come back, you'll have to come back to experience the results of your actions and inactions, then we would all become more responsible stewards of this planet, more effective in our communal relations. We would actually work harder, not just for our own wealth and well-being, but the wealth and well-being of others. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the President of Israel, Mr. Olmert, knew he was going to come back as a Palestinian? Or, if the other people in conflict were reborn on the other side, wouldn't it be important that we create a sense of fairness and justice in our world, where we know that maybe next year or next lifetime, we may not be reborn in Malaysia. We may be reborn, who knows, in Burma, in Africa. Who knows where we will come next time. Because of that, we have to care, that we have to look after our world. And there is so much evidence available about people who sometimes spontaneously remember their past lives. And there is a fascinating stories And obviously in my life as a monk, I've met many people who can recall their past lives. And those recollections of past lives are not easy things to remember. One doesn't remember these things for some financial gain or even any other gain at all. I remember meeting one of the young men who was interviewed in Professor Ian Stevenson's book on 20 cases supportive of reincarnation. And he was a young boy. I met him in the London Buddhist Vihara. And he was telling me, he was only about a 19 or 20 year old at this time. He'd been interviewed when he was very young, recording his previous life in all its detail, had it checked up, no way he could get that information from any other source. They all checked out. He remembered his past life, and I remember speaking to him, and he told me that was the worst thing he ever did, letting on that he could remember his past life. Because he said at school in London, all his fellow pupils, they knew he could remember his past life. And like children do at school, they would tease him endlessly. How's your wife today? They would say to the 8-year-old. And he said he had a terrible time at school because of being teased. But the way he said that, with honest, deep feeling of pain, showed me at least that that was one case and many cases where people remember and they don't get anything positive out of those memories when they tell them to other people. Only sort of difficulties and troubles, which actually shows that these are valid, real memories. They're not the result of wishful thinking, but they come up reluctantly. The desire for people to tell the truth and to meet people they've known before. But these are people who can recall spontaneously, and it is the usual case that people do recall their past lives in the first years when they start speaking, 2.5, 3 years of age or whatever. And that's usually the time when people can recall their previous lives, simply because that's only 3 or 4 years ago that they lived before. But as usually happens, when those memories recede with age, 10 years, 12 years, 13 years, 14 years, usually around the age of puberty, we tend to forget. And there was a classic case of a young boy who was born in Burma who refused to eat rice and curry. You know, sometimes children are fussy with their food, but this young boy was particularly fussy. All he wanted to eat was bread and butter and cups of tea. And of course it all worked out what had happened. He was a British soldier who had died in Burma, who got reborn in a Burmese family, and he still had his stiff upper lip. But according to his family, he remembered being killed in some little battle or skirmish and being reborn. And it was at the time of puberty, maybe 14, 15, 16, that he forgot his liking for bread and butter and cups of tea and started taking on his Burmese life, becoming more acculturalized to the land of his parents. But the point is that people do remember those past lives. If you don't remember them in your early life, sometimes these things jog your memory. You have some event which happens to you, and with that sudden shock, that sudden event, sometimes old memories come flooding in. One of the most fascinating stories I read many years ago concerned a semi-famous TV personality in the UK. When I grew up and used to watch the TV, one of the comedians of that time, who was very often on the TV, was a fellow called Roy Hudd. H-U-D-D. He sometimes had his own TV show. He appeared on other people's TV shows. He was very well known, a household name in UK, but he never made any name at all outside of that country. But he was a well-known personality, a comedian. He wrote an article in the paper at the expense of his reputation about an event when he recalled his previous life. And it's an interesting life that he remembered, because he was saying after giving a performance in some theatre in London, he was driving home when he lost his way. For anyone who's tried to negotiate the one-way system of London, it's quite easy to lose your way sometimes. You want to go straight, but you have to go left. You want to go right, but you have to go straight on. And he got lost. And he went to a part of London he'd never been to before. And he turned a corner, and as he turned a corner, the hairs on the back of his head went up. That experience never happens to me, the hairs on the back of my head, because I'm bald. But it happened to him. And with that electricity going through his body, he knew he'd been in that street before. Just the visual stimulus of those old houses, because you know in so many parts of London they haven't changed for hundreds of years. It's not quite the same as PJ, which every time I come here this changes as new buildings go up. But this is an old city which very rarely changes. And so he recognized the houses, he recognized the street, and he knew that in his previous life he had lived in that street. And he went straight to the house in which he'd lived to knock on the door and ask the new owners if he could come in. The new owners recognized him because he was a TV personality. And so not only did they let him in, but they were so fascinated, so interested to learn some of the history of that house. For those of you who have been to London, you see that in that city that so many famous people have been lived in the past, that if there is any house or building where there has been a famous person, they usually put a little plaque on the wall, a sign in blue saying Winston Churchill lived here, or the Duke of Wellington once lived here. That house also had such a plaque, because in his previous life he was also an entertainer. For anyone who knows the history of entertainment, the most famous of the music hall entertainers 100 years ago was a person called Dan Leno, D-A-N-L-E-N-O, who used to pack the old music halls of London in the Edwardian era, just after the turn of in the 1900s. He was very famous and well known. And that was Roy Hudd in his previous life. He remembered his life in many details just because of the jogging of the memory of seeing the street in which he lived, and there was a plaque on the wall. What was fascinating for me when I read that story, and the person had nothing to gain from writing that story, only the ridicule of those who were skeptical. But what really impressed me was that in his previous life he had been an entertainer, and he'd taken that persona, that character, into his present life as well. He was on the stage before, and in this life he was also on the stage. It does seem, according to the law of rebirth, that our characteristics of our previous life somehow carry on into this life. That even though we may not remember exactly who we are and what we did, there is a tendency, a character trait, which continues on from life to life. And another interesting case of that is a Buddhist, an Australian Buddhist, who lives in Sydney. He's very active, and so I've met him many times. On one occasion I was teaching a meditation retreat in Sydney, and he was my assigned driver to take me from the airport to the meditation center. Maybe a drive of an hour and a half. And on the way we were chatting about many, many things, and that's when he told me about his daughter. His daughter had only been born maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but his daughter had a very clear recollection of who she was before. Because a few years before his daughter was conceived, this man's aunt got very sick. His auntie was a business lady who had never got married, and she was a multi-millionaireess who had a big mansion in Sydney. He told me that his auntie was a successful business lady, was very hard, and there's two things in her life that she hated the most. One was religion, and the other was paying taxes. And when she died, a few months later, his wife became pregnant. When the baby was born, as often happens, the family come around to celebrate and to look at the new member of their clan. And when all of the family members came around, not one but many of them remarked, "Oh, doesn't your new daughter look like Auntie?" There was a facial resemblance, and as soon as that baby started to speak, then all of the recollections came back. He told me that one of the things he'd inherited from his mother's house was the old coffee cups. And he said that one morning he came into the room with a cup of coffee, and his little daughter, he said, went ballistic. She went crazy. "Daddy, that's my cup. Give me my cup back. I want my cup back." Every time she went close to her old house, "Daddy, take me back to my mansion." But what was fascinating, he told me, that one day they were driving along one of the motorways in Sydney, and they went past a billboard, a big sign, which had been erected by the local government about taxes. And this little 3-year-old girl said, "Daddy, what does tax mean? And how do you explain the concept of tax to a 3-year-old? But the father tried his best by saying, "Well, darling, when you get some pocket money, some of it will have to go to the government." And this little 3-year-old immediately replied, "Daddy, when I get any money, I'm not giving anything to any government." A characteristic from an old lady who did business was now transferred to a young girl of 3 years of age who hadn't got an idea what taxes really were. Inclinations, tendencies, they're the things which carry on from life to life. But how can we remember those things? It's important for us to know, because it's one thing to hear stories like this of other people. And even though that may be somebody you respect and know very well, it could be your husband, your wife tells you those things. But it doesn't mean as much if it's your own memory, your own recall of what actually happened. And I think it's important that our modern world starts to accept the law of karma and reincarnation. And the reason I say this again is because unless we realize we're going to come back again to this world, let alone to some heaven realm, but come back to this world, only then will we do what's necessary to care for this planet and look after it. It's the biggest incentive to know that you're going to live in this place, not just for the next 30, 40 years, but for a long time. And it changes the whole meaning of our life and what we're doing. It's the difference between living in a rented house and owning your house, or driving a rented car and that's your vehicle. If it's rented, you only have it for a short time, you don't look after it so much. But if you know that's going to be with you for a long, long time, then you really care and look after it, maintain it well. So I would actually expect that if we understood the meaning of rebirth and accepted that, it would actually make a huge change to our societies. And the whole idea of reincarnation, it's not something which began in Asia. Anyone who knows their history knows that in ancient Greece, all of the philosophers, almost without exception, all believed in reincarnation. From Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates, they all believed in reincarnation. If you don't believe me, read the last chapter of Plato's Republic. A whole chapter devoted to reincarnation. Heraclitus, he was a great philosopher, who actually said in his writings that he recalled a previous life as a fish. Similar to Buddhism, where the reincarnation can actually go from a human realm to animal realms to other realms, not always from human to human. And even the great Pythagoras, the one you know from school about the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the squares on the other two sides. He didn't just know mathematics, but he propounded at length the idea of reincarnation. And it's not just in ancient Greece, the early Christians also believed in reincarnation. One of the great church fathers, Origen, he wrote extensively about reincarnation. And not just in those religions, not just the religions in India either, but the Druze in the Middle East, who are a combination of Islam and Christianity. The Indians of the Northwest Pacific also believe in reincarnation. There's so many different cultures, even the Kabbalistic Jewish community accept reincarnation. I remember talking with a rabbi once who came, he was the spiritual director of the Jewish school, Carmel School in Perth, and he brought his kids to the monastery where I live. And straight away the first thing he said, we believe in reincarnation too. They do really, because he was one of the Kabbalistic Jews, the mystic sect of the Jewish tradition. So it is not just an ancient idea, it is a wide-ranging idea. But in order for us to make sure that it's accepted, we have to understand the mechanism, what happens at death, and also to accept that sometimes we can recall the whole process. Because even now, people may not be able to remember their past lives, but there's so many people can remember the gap between lives when they have what's called in our modern world near-death experiences, otherwise known as out-of-the-body experiences. Times when, because of some accident or some heart attack or some disease, you die. But you die temporarily, simply because of the skills of the doctors and the advances of modern medicine, where once you die and go forever, that you are brought back to life again. And the people who are brought back to life come and tell the tale of what it's like to die. Many of you may have had that experience. This is an experience which goes across cultures and religions. It doesn't just happen to Buddhists. Happens to anybody. Because what happens is that a person floats out of their body. The Buddha called that the Manomayakaya, the mind-made body. And this is where our ghosts come from. The Manomayakaya, complete in all its details. And you look like you did just when you died. So you appear to your loved one just as you would when you died. So make sure you're well dressed when you die. There was an old story of this man who was again a business person in Australia. And being a business person, he never liked wasting money. So he told his wife, when I die, I don't want you to put any clothes on me in the coffin. I want to be naked. Because I don't like just wasting things. Give those clothes to charity or sell them or something. But what's the point of putting them in the coffin when they'll only be burnt or they will be rot away under the earth? And anyway, he said, you know what it's like in business? I've done some very dodgy deals in my life. I know what I've done, and I know where I'm going. And it's so hot down there, I don't think I need any clothes. So because it was his last wish, his wife had no choice but to tell the funeral directors to actually no clothes in his coffin and to bury him, or actually he was cremated naked. And because that's how he was in his coffin, that's what happened 2 weeks later when his ghost came to see the wife. There he was, naked, in the bedroom, in front of his wife. What do you want? What do you want? Said his wife. And his wife said, have you still got some of my clothes? Have you got my old golfing trousers and a sweater? He said, what do you need those for? Said his wife. I thought you went down there. And he said, yes, I have gone to hell. But don't you know? There's so many rich people in hell, they've now installed air conditioning. There's air con down in hell. There's so many rich people down there. But some of you may have had those experiences. And they're incredible experiences because you can see and hear what's going on. One of the favourite stories which I tell was again of an English lady. This is an English story, come from a London hospital. Another wealthy person who was just having minor surgery. But sometimes even with minor surgery, things can go wrong. When you're under anaesthetic, sometimes there are complications. And this was what happened to her. Things started going terribly wrong and she died on the operating table. Now, because she was a wealthy person, her doctor was very polite to her. Except when she was dead or dying. And it was that point the doctor, in the heat of the moment, struggling to try and get this woman to her heart going again, in the panic of the moment, said, while he was trying to fix up the problem, don't give up on me now, you bitch. That's what the doctor said. Now, if there's any surgeons here, take this as a lesson for you. Because she heard everything he said. They managed to bring her back to life again. It was only a small complication. And she survived the operation without any problem. And when he came to see her, as doctors do, after you come out of the anaesthetic on the first post-operation visit, he said, Madam, we came jolly close to losing you that time. And she said, yes, but why did you call me a bitch? How did you know? You couldn't have known. You were unconscious at the time. You were dead. So be careful what you say when somebody dies. They may be listening. They may be looking. They see everything which you do. So make sure, if it's a partner in business or a loved one, make sure you go to their funeral because they're watching. But those are anecdotes, and there are many of them, and some of you will probably have your share of those anecdotes. But what was very interesting was that there was a professor of medicine in the Netherlands called Professor Pim van Lommel, who as a young registrar in the hospital somewhere in Holland, he had personal experience of people who said they remembered conversations and medical procedures when they were basically unconscious. And those experiences stayed with him for many years. when he became a professor of medicine, he decided to do some research on NDEs. Is it going? I'll try the other microphone. The ghosts have got into this one. That's much better. On near-death experiences. He wanted to find out whether these things were true, or just hearsay, or whether you could actually quantify them, to examine them and find out what's going on. And so it was very easy for him to do some rational, well-founded scientific research. His sample body, because he was a professor of about 3 or 4 hospitals in the Netherlands, and he chose about 3 or 4 of these hospitals, and his sample group were anybody who came into that hospital with cardiac arrest, had a heart attack, whose heart wasn't working. And once they survived, he would give them a questionnaire, and they would be asked simple questions to see if any of them had experiences during the time they were supposed to be unconscious. And he'd also check what had happened in the operating table, the procedures and the conversations. So he had some independent means of checking whether what they heard or saw, for those who did hear or see anything, whether it was actually true or not. It was very easy to find some cases where what they remembered seeing and hearing actually did occur. Not sort of general feelings, but conversations which were recorded and actually happened, and medical procedures which were actually carried out. This wasn't coincidence. It was very easy to see and make sure that what they said they remembered actually occurred. But the major part of his research, and the most interesting part, was that he discovered only about 10% of the patients had these recollections. And those were only the people who not only had heart attack, whose heart had stopped, but also who had no brain activity whatsoever, who were brain dead. Not clinically brain dead, because apparently to be clinically brain dead, your brain has to stop working for 24 hours. So I was told by doctors. And then you can certify, yes, you're clinically brain dead. And he wrote an article about his research in The Lancet in December 2001, if anyone wants to check me out. His conclusion was, consciousness survives the death of the brain. And it was so radical that it was reported in many mainstream newspapers, which is where I first read about it, when I downloaded the article from the internet. What he found was, and he argued at length, saying these people were conscious. They were hearing and they were seeing. But it cannot be explained by any brain activity. The brain was completely dysfunctional at that time. There's no way at all that that consciousness could be a byproduct of a dysfunctional, inactive, broken brain. And that was his major conclusion. He argued it at length. And if you don't believe me, look at it on the internet. Lancet, the journal of the British Medical Association. This is not some New Age magazine. This is one of the oldest scientific journals in our world. He argued at length that consciousness was independent of the brain at this time. And if you don't believe that, one of my favorite stories of a disciple in Perth. I love telling this story. Some of you have heard it before. He was a meditator. He would not have deep meditation, but one day he got into a very, very deep state. Again, this is a true story, which I wrote about in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. He was meditating at home. Just a weekend, he told his wife, an Australian guy, he told his wife, I'm going into my bedroom to meditate for half an hour. Which he did. But maybe an hour and a half later, he hadn't come out. So she went into his bedroom to check on him. He saw him sitting perfectly straight and so still, too still, she couldn't see him breathing. She checked and the abdomen was not rising at all. So she rang for the ambulance. In Australia it's 000. Come quickly! My husband's not breathing! Now sometimes you can be breathing so subtly an ordinary person can't see that. But when the medics came, these trained ambulance men, they rushed into his room. They could see no breath at all, but worse, they took his pulse. There was no pulse. So they put him into the stretcher and they rushed him into the back of the ambulance. And going at 100 miles an hour or faster, going through every red light, swerving around the traffic, making haste because every second counts when there's no pulse. And the sirens were wailing, they screeched to a halt in front of the emergency rooms of Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital, for those of you who know Perth. They wheeled him in, and as they were wheeling him in, they were connecting him up to the instruments. The first instrument, the ECG, to see what heart activity there was. As soon as they turned the monitor on, flat line, beep, no activity. The heart had stopped. When they turned on the EEG, the machine which measures your brain activity to see if there's anything going on there. Another flat line. Usually it goes beep, beep, beep. I've been in hospital many times. But when it's dead, a flat line. Beep. He had no brain activity. He was dead. But don't get afraid, because he was only in deep meditation. It was very, very good fortune. The doctor on duty in the emergency room that day had parents who had come from India, who had migrated to Australia, and he had grown up in Australia. But he'd always remembered his parents saying that in deep meditation, some of these yogis, they can suspend all their life activities. And he knew from the wife that he had got into this state through meditation. So he decided not to send this guy to the morgue yet, which was a very fortunate decision, because he was later to come out of that state. And if he'd have opened his eyes and sat up in the morgue, he'd have probably killed two morgue attendants of sheer terror. So the doctor decided to put on these electric shock defibrillators to try and stimulate the heart back into activity. Again, you may have seen that yourself or seen that in the movies, on the TV. Apparently there's a TV show called ER. Is it Emergency Room? So I've never seen that, but I'm sure they must have that on the TV. And apparently when you put those electric shocks on a person, your back arches, you go a centimeter or two off the table. Many, many times, according to his wife, they tried to shock him into activity.
but nothing worked. Nothing worked. It was only when he decided to come out of his meditation that he opened his eyes, bent up, and as soon as he opened his eyes, the monitors, beep, 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 perfectly normal. And the doctor gave him a quick checkup. There's nothing wrong with him, and sent him home. He walked home, and he said the only unpleasant part of that experience was the scolding he got from his wife. Don't you ever do that again. You scared me so much. But as for him, during that whole period, he was perfectly conscious, but not of his body, deep inside his mind. What experiences like that, the anecdotes, but also the research of people like Professor Pim van Lommel, prove is that consciousness or mind does not stop when you die. When the brain stops, when the body stops, the mind continues on. That is one of the soundest, strongest pieces of evidence we have of the continuity of consciousness. That is a start for understanding rebirth or reincarnation. If your consciousness, if your mind is that strong, that it'll survive the death of the body, the end of the brain, of course reincarnation is possible. You understand how it works. It's just because in the stupid Western countries who are just so dogmatic, who continue to deny evidence which is so strong, being put on a wonderful foundation, that they still think, oh, when you die it's all over and no one survives. The truth of the matter is, the evidence is there. As I used to say in, what was that program which I never watched, the X-Files, the truth is out there. It's a cover-up. But the truth is out there. That's why I quote these scientific documents. I was a scientist before, I know what science is. Once you understand this, you understand that the mind does survive death, and sometimes you'll know that for yourself, because that's what will happen to you. Understanding that gives you an idea of the process of reincarnation. And understand that some of these memories are not stored in the body. Those things which are stored in the body you lose at death, but there's some which are stored in the mind. And those are the ones which can reconnect with the previous life. Now, the title of this talk is Remembering Previous Lives. And how do you do that? You can understand it's a possibility if you understand what the mind is and how it will survive death. But also, when you energize that mind, when you give it a little bit of power, which happens in meditation, you have other abilities too. One of the things which the Buddha would often say, that if you cultivate mindfulness, in other words, make your mindfulness strong and powerful, he said you can remember things said and done long ago. That's a quote from the sutras. By cultivating the mindfulness, by empowering it, and I mentioned in previous talks, you strengthen your mindfulness with stillness. The more still and quiet you are, the more energy flows into the mind. You don't waste it. Sometimes your mind is like a bucket, but it has so many holes in it, all the energy leaks out into thinking, planning, remembering, complaining. If you stop doing those things, the bucket fills up. The energy starts flowing into the mind. Not only do you get very alert, very aware, but very powerful too. You start getting what in the old sutras they call psychic powers. Abilities which are natural, but just only a few people have, simply because only a few people bother to train their minds and make it powerful. In the same way that Olympic athletes, you have to train to be able to do these amazing feats of speed or gymnastic ability. Again, I've never seen the Cirque du Soleil, these acrobats who perform incredible feats. But one of my the young acolytes in my monastery right now, training to be a monk, was a masseur who worked on some of these gymnasts, and so got an insight into how hard they train and how they can move their body and gyrate their body and to become now gymnasts who perform around the world in the famous Cirque du Soleil, coming from Montreal in Canada apparently. And it's only through training they can do this. So you can imagine the people who train their minds in deep meditation, they too get these amazing abilities. Now, I'm sure that if the question hasn't come yet, the question often comes straight to me, well, Ajahn Brahm, can you remember your past lives? And I'm not just saying this to try and avoid the question, but I mentioned this before, that one of the rules set down by the Buddha is monks can't actually say this. But I want to get around this, have a loophole. To keep my rules, but by giving you an understanding of what happens and how it happens. So I just mentioning, when I first started developing my mind and going down the path of remembering all these things, one of the first things I remembered was not a past life, because I can't tell you about those, but an early life, an early part of this life. And it's a very important story because it shows you what the process is, how it happens, and sometimes how strange it is. After a deep meditation many years ago, I don't know where I got this process from, but I decided to ask myself, what is my earliest memory? Just that word, those words, what is my earliest memory? For those of you who have meditated and got into reasonably deep states of meditation, the more peaceful you are, just the more obedient is your mind. You give it a suggestion and it just does it. To show you the power of such a mind, that many of you yogis can try a little technique which I learnt on my first retreat. The teacher there said, we're going to get up at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning, but don't set your alarm clocks. Instead, before you go to sleep, just tell yourself, I will get up at 5 o'clock, I will get up at 5 o'clock, I will get up at 5 o'clock. Say it clearly, repeat it to yourself 3 times, and then forget about it. And of course I did that, and every morning I woke up 5 o'clock, 1 or 2 minutes either side. If you've never tried that, try it. Tomorrow morning is a Saturday, it doesn't matter if you don't get up on time to go to work. Try it. And if you're so worried because you have some appointment, say you're going to get up, say, I don't know, 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, just say, set your alarm clock to 6:05, just in case. And then say to yourself, before you go to bed tonight, I will wake up at 6, I will wake up at 6 a.m., I will wake up at 6 a.m. Forget about it and go to sleep. You'll be surprised, many of you. You'll wake up 2 or 3 minutes either side of 6 a.m. It's amazing just how we can condition and program our mind, and it works. But the deeper you go in meditation, the easier it is to program. So when I said to myself, what is my earliest memory? Immediately, something happened. What came up was a smell. Completely unexpected, because I was sitting in a meditation hall, a very, very strong smell came into my nose. It wasn't a real smell, because there's no smells out there, which was strange. And immediately I recognized that smell. It was the smell of my baby's pram when I was a newborn infant. And immediately with that recognition, with my eyes closed, the vision of my baby's pram came back to me, clear in all its detail. You can even, because once you've remembered it once, you can remember it again. A black pram with a little string on the front. And in front was my favorite toy as a 3 or 4 week old baby, a little pig called Porky. A blue plastic pig, which in those days had some beans inside of it, and my mother would walk it on its two legs and make me laugh. I loved that little pig. I was only a few weeks old, and I remember that clearly. What was happening was I was spanning the gap of, say, 30 or 40 years so easily, and remembering something which happened a long, long time ago. Very different than the ordinary memories you have. Because you, when you remember what you did this afternoon, or you did this morning, or yesterday, you don't remember much. Just that you went to work, or you parked the car, or you rang up your mother or something. But these are memories which come back as if you're reliving the experience. You're right there. And you can look, you can feel. And also, one of the other weird parts of this experience is that it comes with a sense of certainty. You know that that was you. That's a strange part to it, but it's true. I found out later, because I was a physicist, a mathematician, not a biologist. I only did a couple of years of biology at school, but I sort of majored in physics and maths and did theoretical physics. But when I told that story one time, a doctor came up to me and said, you know, an interesting part of that story is that the truth of the matter is, the first sense which dominates for a baby is their sense of smell. That is the dominant sense for a newly born child. And I know that from experience, because I remember you recognize your mum and your father and your pram and your surroundings, not by what they look like. You don't recognize your mother by what she sounds like. You recognize your mother and your surroundings by what she smells like. Babies know their world through smell. And I know that is true, because I remember being there clearly. If you want to go earlier, all you'd say to yourself after you explore that experience is, earlier please. And your mind is just so easy, so pliable, you get an earlier memory. Now here I can't say what happened to me. I'm going to go to another lady. And I got her permission to write her story in my book. And she is from KL, but she lives in Australia. And when she did this on a meditation retreat, she actually was a newborn baby. And coming back to that memory, she felt herself being held in her mother's arms. And she looked up to her mother and was shocked. In this very, very clear memory of her early life, the first couple of weeks, the face of the mother breastfeeding her was not the face of the mother she knew. She was so shocked, she came in the next possible interview and told me what had happened and said, I think my mother is not my real mum. I think she's adopted me. I think there's something she's never said. Now imagine what that would do to you. Because you've seen someone suckling you in your first weeks of life who is not your mum. At least not the mum you think you have. And very often people do get adopted at an early time. And your new parents don't want to tell you, because it just complicates things. So I told her, well look, as soon as you end this retreat, you better go back and ask your mum. And that's what she did. Just a few days after the retreat had finished, she went up to her mother and said, Mother, is this something you've not told me? Now she was maybe about in her 40s, 50s probably, and her mother was, you know, 70 or 80. She said, what do you mean? And she recounted the story of the event which happened in her meditation, a clear memory. And her mother was so interested. and said, "What did that lady look like?" And her, I think about 50-year-old daughter, gave a very clear description of the woman she had seen suckling her. The mother was so impressed. "That was your wet nurse. I hired her after you were born to feed you." Her mother came from a very wealthy family in Keo, and so could afford a wet nurse. Her mother had never told her that, because the wet nurse only was employed for a couple of months. And her child could remember, in the space of 40-50 years, that really impressed this woman's mother and impressed her as well. She found some information which you can't get from anywhere else. Memories of an early life. Go earlier. And if you go earlier, sometimes people remember the experience in your mother's womb, floating in the fluids. Don't think that a baby in a womb, a fetus, hasn't got consciousness. They have. If you follow this procedure, you will know that for yourself, because you remember what it was like in your mother's womb. Earlier, please. And that's when people get their previous life. Another time, another place. Anyone who tries this, there's a little warning. Because very often when people try this technique, the first thing which they get is their death. Because that's the earliest or the closest memory to this life. And very often death is painful and unpleasant. And so because of that, some people have just through their meditation asked earliest memory, and they've got their death, and they don't like it, and they come out straight away, they never want to do it again. And I keep telling you, if that happens to you, quickly say earlier, please. Flip through that and go to something more pleasant. Because I'm teaching this, and it's effective, because I want more people actually to recognize that they have lived before. So that you know that there is such a thing as reincarnation, and you know where you've come from. And it sometimes explains an enormous amount about you, your tendencies, and why you do the things you do, why you married the person you married, and no one else. How many, let's put your hands up, be honest, how many of you fell in love at first sight? Anyone fell in love at first sight? Ah, oh, come on, I won't tell your husband. You know, there's an Australian girl, I don't know if you know this story, if you've read the magazines. I think her name was, I forget her surname, Kelly was her first name. I forget what her surname was, because she's got a new surname now. She was just a young actress, an aspiring would-be actress in Adelaide in South Australia. Maybe about 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, like many young people, that one evening she was going to the movies with her best friend, another girl. They're just young girls. And they went to the movie, and the movie was Grease. Remember the movie Grease? You remember who starred in the movie? John Travolta, yeah. Yeah, John Travolta. And she looked at the poster outside the movie theatre, and it was obviously a big picture of John Travolta. And she said to her friend, "I'm going to marry him." And that was crazy. You know, this was a little girl in Adelaide. Sure, she wanted to be an actress, but, you know, maybe 10% of girls want to be actresses. And she said to her friend, "I'm going to marry that guy. And it's the most stable relationship in Hollywood. Kelly and John Travolta have been married for years." It happened. How on earth can that occur? It's a crazy thing to say that you're going to marry a movie star. But she knew. There's a guy I know who said that he was working in the northwest of Australia, and he saw this girl at a distance, and he turned around to his best friend and his mate, "I'm going to marry her." Hadn't even talked to her, hadn't even met her. And they'd been married happily for many years too. How on earth can that happen? You see someone, you know, I'm going to marry them. It's obvious. You've known each other before. It's just carrying on where you left off. Have you ever met someone who makes your stomach turn and you want to get out of the room straight away? That could also be someone you were married to before. Or someone who's done you some violence, or someone who's created problems for you. Because we do have those recognitions sometimes. We don't recognize them specifically, we just have a feeling. We don't know why, but we really like that person, or we don't like that one. There must be some reason for these things, and it's obviously there's some recognition deep inside of you from the past. And these are not recognitions which are stored in your body, because people who remember their past lives, or recall their past lives, their past lives are sometimes genetically different, sometimes gender different. Here's a nice story. A couple of my disciples in Perth, they were wanting a child, and eventually the wife became pregnant. She was so overjoyed she was going to give birth. And there's very good medical cover in Australia. So she went to the prenatal clinic. She had an ultrasound 5 days before the birth. A perfectly normal, healthy pregnancy. Except in those 5 days before the last ultrasound and her delivery, the baby had strangled itself on the umbilical cord. So it was a stillbirth. I performed the funeral service for that little baby, Charlie. Because they were Buddhists, they accepted it with a sense of no peace. And one of the touching events of the funeral was little Charlie. They dressed him up in the baby clothes they'd already bought in the coffin. It was an open coffin, only a small coffin. And they led the coffin up, almost vertical. And the whole family, including me, stood around to take a photograph. So that little Charlie, they named their child, could get into the family album. That's so cute. And then they closed the coffin and it was cremated. What I didn't know, they didn't tell me until afterwards, that before the coffin was closed, while I wasn't looking and the funeral directors weren't looking, they got a small ballpoint pen and they drew a line on the baby's right heel. This is common in some cultures when a baby dies like that. Because the theory was that that child had tried to come in their life but didn't quite make it. And they wanted to see if it would come back again. To see if their next child had a birthmark of a line on its heel. Professor Ian Stevenson, who's done heaps of research on this, has actually written a whole book when he was a visiting fellow of Magdalen College in Oxford. And we've got a copy of that book in our library. It's a fascinating thing to read about birthmarks and how they relate to your previous lives. And you have to put these lines on places where you don't usually have birthmarks. On the heel of the foot, it's very rare to have birthmarks there. So they put the line on the heel. Short time later, she became pregnant again. She really wanted a baby, wanted a child. This time, she gave birth to a girl. Very healthy girl called Anne. Who's got a line on her heel where they made the mark. She's got the birthmark. What was fascinating to me to see Anne grow up was she was a tomboy. She's so strong and masculine. You know why? Because she was a boy in her last life. That's where it comes from. You know, why is it you see some men who are so effeminate? It's obvious why, because there were girls in their past life. Why is it that some girls are just so tough that make Margaret Thatcher look like a wimp? Because there were boys in their past life. You've actually crossed that gender. Isn't it wonderful that we can cross genders. So actually men, all you men here, if you go deep into your past life, you know what it's like to be a girl. You may be a bit more sensitive. And all you girls, if you go far enough back, you were a man. So you can understand how men feel as well. Isn't it wonderful if you can understand how each other feels? So it's useful to understand these things and to go back into the past. And sometimes it just makes the present have much more meaning. Understand why your journey in this life, once you have what we call the big picture, that everything starts to make sense. Now why you have to go through what you do have to go through in this life. Why this happens to you and not other people. Why it is that some people have long lives, other people short lives. It's a tragedy if you only had one life and some little kids, 6 or 7 years of age, get cancer and die. You think that's really unfair. They had no chance. When you realize this is one life amongst many, it makes it more fair. Yeah, they had a short life this time. Next life, they're going to have a longer life. We learn so much. If we could only remember what it was like to be poor, to be hungry, to be cold, if we could remember past life like that, we'd be just doing so much charity work for others. We could never pass by a hungry person if we remembered what it was really like. If you remembered times in your long distant past when you were alone, criticized, rejected, you remembered what it felt like, you'd have so much compassion and friendship for others. It's only because we can't remember, because we're so busy thinking, doing things, we don't develop the ability to recall the past and learn from it and become better human beings as a result. So remembering the past is not just for some fascinating idea, just, you know, for a bit of interesting stuff to do. It actually really enhances who you are. Puts you in the picture, the big picture, so you understand what life is all about. Many religions teach reincarnation. If it is true, and I say absolutely is true, surely it's something you should check out. Find out, but not just from the books, find out for yourselves. Those on retreat, you may have a chance to do it. Next time you have a deep meditation, remember, what is my earliest memory? And see what comes up. Thank you. Okay, are there any questions from the floor, first of all, before I go on to the written questions on this interesting subject of reincarnation, rebirth, and how to remember? I didn't actually mention the other ways, like through hypnosis. Sometimes hypnosis gets it right, sometimes it doesn't. But certainly through meditation, it's always absolutely true memories. Okay, I'll go through the first written question here. Dear Ajahn Brahm, we share merits with our beloved departed ones. If after 49 days that I reborn to another realm, then where or who do our merits go? Usually that when we share our merits, our good karma, spreading them to our loved ones who aren't here. If they don't, we don't say this person or that person, we say relations, or maybe to all beings. And so you always have some relations who are hanging around who can accept those merits. 49 days is common to all traditions. That once there was a disciple in Thailand who died of cancer. I did their funeral service for them, or rather participated in their funeral service. A few weeks after the funeral service was complete, the father came to my monastery. I saw them because he came to me, first of all. Very concerned. He was living in a house in the northeast of Thailand with about 12 or 13 other people living in that house. Now, his extended family. Like the old times, that when you have breakfast, they have breakfast on the floor and everyone's sitting around sharing a meal. And as they were sharing their breakfast, one of his daughters said, "You know, I had a really strange dream last night. My sister came to me to say she'd been here long enough, now she was taking leave to say goodbye." And when she said that, the other 13 or 14 people went absolutely quiet. And one by one, they all recounted that they had exactly the same dream that night. 13 or, I can't remember the exact number, about 13 or 14 people had the same dream that their sister or their daughter or their cousin had come into their dreams and say, "I've stayed here long enough, now's the time to go." And so the father family got on the first bus, came to the monastery and said, "What's going on? This is spooky." And I said, "She's come to say goodbye. What do you expect? That's what the answer is." But as soon as he left, I looked at the calendar and counted the days since the death. 49 days exactly. That was the case. They stayed for 49 days. You don't have dreams exactly the same in 13 or 14 people at the same night, unless there's something happening there. "I have a back problem, a mild curvature of my spine. I have difficulty sitting up straight during meditation. Does poor posture during meditation cause harm to the body? If I wear a back brace, will that restrict my breathing and hinder my meditation?" See, however you want. Modern research says the best posture for the body is 115 degrees. So straight posture is not good for you, apparently. It causes you back pain. So lean back. It feels good. You know why it feels good? Because it is good. "Is it moral to criticize others before understanding and cultivating metta? Ajahn, when I heard someone criticize Ajahn, I felt heartbroken because Ajahn has sacrificed effort and time to benefit millions of sentient beings. Maybe a few. No matter who you are, you'll always get criticized. So it's par for the course. So don't get surprised when someone criticizes you, you idiot." But are you an idiot? What do I know if you're an idiot? I don't even know who asked the question. So, when someone criticizes you, what should you do? If they call you a dog, look at your bottom. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of the problem. So when they criticize you, look to see if you deserve it. If you don't deserve it, doesn't matter. Forget about it. "Is there any intermediate stage between one existence and the next? An Intipitaka and only Vinaya Sutta are preached by the Buddha." Yes, there is an intermediate stage. It's only the Abhidharma, the commentaries, say no, but the Tipitaka itself, the teachings of the Buddha, actually say there is an Antara stage. So yes, there is, and ghosts come back and tell me yes, there are intermediate stage. It's true. And in the Tipitaka, only Vinaya Sutra preached by the Buddha, yes, that's true too. Only the Vinaya and the Sutras, Abhidharma came afterwards. How do I know that I am remembering my past life when the memory comes? Could it be just illusions or just my own thinking? If it comes from deep meditation, you make that suggestion, what is my earliest memory? It comes immediately, it comes with clarity, you can explore it. It's not just a vague memory, it's precise. You know the names, the people. It comes with details. It's not sort of some misty thing. For most people, the illusions are misty, unclear, foggy. You're not really quite sure. It may be this, it may be that. If it's a maybe type of memory, it's not a past life memory. Past life memories, it's weird, but they are clear. And they also, it's hard to describe this, but it comes with this feeling of absolute certainty, that was me. And people who actually have this, they all come with the same, yeah, look, I don't care what other people say, that was me, that I know that was me. No doubt, 100% certainty. There's very few things you are so certain of, because you're re-experiencing it. It's very different than an ordinary memory. It's like you're right back there. And if you really want to, if it's a memory which is not that far away, you could actually go and find out. find out your names, who you got married to, where you lived, and check it out. Interesting thing to do. Nowadays you don't even need to travel anywhere, just get on the internet and check out. The Ajahn Brahm, is book-based belief religious? In book-based belief religious, that God's laws are omnipotent, then why is it necessary to make use of punitive man-made laws to enforce their God's laws? Any comments, please? Unfortunately, the gods aren't omniscient or omnipotent. So, you know, we have to take responsibility for ourselves. Remember that story I said the other day about the devotee of Kuan Yin who was in the floods, you know, and on the roof of the houses? I did say that here, didn't I? Really? Must have been some. Okay, this is a nice story. I think it was in Taiwan. I'm sure I said that here, didn't I? About Taiwan, the floods, and the devotee of Kuan Yin was caught in the floods. Oh, my goodness. Okay, in Taiwan, some years ago, there was a priest, a reverend, who was stuck in his temple when the floods came. And he was in the upper story, by the window, when a boat came past and said, "Reverend, jump in, we've come to save you." He said, no, I don't need to be saved. I'm a devotee of the Goddess of Mercy, Kuan Yin. I've been praying all day. I've got faith in Kuan Yin that she will save me." He said, "Look, don't be stupid, Reverend. Jump in. You know, the flood waters are rising. This is dangerous. This is life-threatening. Jump in." "No, I have faith in the Goddess of Mercy. This is a test of my faith. I've been chanting, a devotee, all my life. She'll save me. No worries." So they had to go off and save other people. They couldn't waste time on that reverend. So they went away. Flood waters rose. So he was on top of the roof of his temple on those little curly bits on the corners, hanging on for grim life. The waters were rising. And another boat came. And the driver of the boat said, "We've heard about you, reverend. Jump in, this is your last chance, the last boat, the waters are rising, if you don't jump in, you're going to drown." And he said, "Look, I have faith in the Goddess of Mercy, Kuan Yin, she will save me, I'm a devotee of hers, she saved me in the past, she'll save me now, I don't need any boat, go away." And I had no choice, I had to go away. Flood waters rose, and now he was hanging on to the TV aerial. When the helicopter came, they lowered the rope, say, "Look, this is your last chance. We've heard about you. We really admire your faith. People of faith like yours are wonderful. But now, get hold of the rope." And he said, "No. This is a test. This is a test of my devotion to the Goddess of Mercy, Kuan Yin. She will save me, I'm sure." "Don't be stupid," they shouted down. "I'm not stupid," he shouted up. And they could not make him get hold of the rope. So you know what happened? Flood waters rose and he drowned. So when he went to heaven, he was in a bad mood. And he demanded to see the so-called Goddess of Mercy. "Kuan Yin, come over here. I had faith in you and you let me down. I was a devotee of yours for years. I praised you to other people, I chanted, I gave offerings, and you let me down. Why did you do that? Why didn't you help?" And Kuan Yin, the Goddess of Mercy, smiled benevolently and said, "I did help. Did I not send you two boats and one helicopter?" Now you understand about omnipotence and stuff like that. Sometimes we expect gods and Kuan Yin to do everything. There's so many devotees these days, they're so busy. Wow, heaps of things. Okay, that'll have to go later. Okay, oh, there's heaps of questions. They're going to be here all night. "Dear Ajahn Sir, in general, can we see the same facial features or physical features of people who have been reborn again? When they're young, they sometimes carry those features, but they lose them when they get old. So when you see a baby born, sometimes you actually see their features to see if they were, you know, the uncle and auntie from a previous life. Because sometimes we do tend to want to actually to join the people we love. We get reborn into the same families very often. Birds of a feather flock together. And it's true, people actually like that, they do get reborn together. Is the explanation of homosexual gays that they were females previously, or is it because of their present life latent tendencies in their mind? Thank you very much. A combination of both. And sometimes it is genetic. And so look, please be kind to people who are homosexuals. Don't reject them. Because, you know, that people who are gays, they're great people, have a wonderful lot to give in this world. They're no different than anybody else. So you should actually allow just their sexual tendencies, you know, to manifest. Because if you repress them, you cause enormous pain and suffering to homosexuals. And those are sort of some group, all of you women who knew what it was like in the old days to be repressed and regarded as second-class people. That's how gays feel now in many societies. So especially the women should actually go out of their way to actually to give them some compassion. Allow them to be. Dear Ajahn, how did you study under Ajahn Chah who did not speak English? One of the prime ministers of Thailand came to visit him once and said to Ajahn Chah, said, "You've got so many Western monks. How did you teach them when you can't speak a word of English?" And he said, "Oh, it's so easy to teach Westerners." He says, "Exactly like teaching a water buffalo. You pull them this way, you pull them that way, you hit them until they do the right thing." That's what Ajahn Chah said. The prime minister cracked up laughing. I have experience. Eventually we learnt Thai. I have experience of events which were going to happen. Most of the time are unpleasant moments for a split of a few seconds and they really happen. Does this mean that consciousness travels beyond time? It's weird that sometimes you can see the future, but a lot of times it's uncertain. There was a friend of mine, a fellow monk, and he said that he had sometimes visions of the future. He had a constant vision coming up in his dreams time and time again when he was a young man of his sister drowning in the family pool in Pasadena. This was 35, 40 years ago. And one day his father was quite wealthy. One day he was sitting by the pool sunning himself, a young man just hanging out, and the dream started to replay itself. He started actually seeing the death of his sister. And because of that dream, he could intervene and stop the death. He saved his sister's life. And that gave him great faith in the power of such prognostic or future-telling dreams. Later on, as a young American, he went to stay in New Zealand. And like many Americans at that time, he started getting into smoking pot. He also had a dream that the house was raided by the New Zealand police. However, he was so stupid, he didn't take any account of that. And when it happened, he was kicking himself because he got deported. But the third dream he had, we kept on telling me of. Remember, this was just after the Vietnam War, after the fall of Saigon, Phnom Penh, and Vientiane, the capital of Laos. And our monastery was really close to the border between Laos and Cambodia. He said he knew how he was going to die because he had a recurring dream of being chased across the paddy fields by the Viet Cong and being shot in the back of the head. He said, "That's how I'm going to die, I know. It's going to happen." Because he had two dreams which worked and this was the third one. However, that's not how he died, because he did disrobe, he went back to US, got married and was actually killed in a head-on collision. But sometimes the dreams are right, sometimes they are wrong, and that's why you can't trust such dreams. Dear Ajahn Brahm, rebirth and reincarnation, is there a difference? The only difference is a technical one on whether there's a self or not a self, but use the words interchangeably, don't be pedantic. How is subconscious passed from one life to another? Imagine a mango. I like mangoes. Sometimes you get the whole mango. These days, you know, people treat me like a king. I probably eat better than Sultan of Selangor these days down here. But you know, sometimes you get a mango, you can actually peel it yourself. You know, sometimes I don't get any exercise at all. Sometimes when people give me a cup of tea, it's already pre-stirred. I don't even get that exercise to stir my own tea. Anyway, a mango. Once you've eaten a mango, and you taste how sweet it is. You know, different mangoes have different flavors. And then you plant the seed. A few weeks later, it might germinate. Maybe another couple of years, you've got a shoot coming up. Maybe, I don't know what the time is, maybe 5 or 10 years, you've got a new mango tree. And you taste another mango from that new tree. That new mango will be the same sort of type as the old mango. If the old mango was sweet, so will the new mango be sweet. It will have some characteristics which have gone across from one mango to the next mango. But as any atom or molecule or cell from that original mango, now in the new mango, what's gone across from the first mango to the new mango? There's probably not even an atom from the original mango in the new mango. But a whole process of cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, has gone from one mango into the seed, into the tree, into the new mango. There's a connection there. It's not a different mango, it has some of the same characteristics of the original. But nothing has gone across. It's a cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect process. That's exactly how rebirth happens. At any few moments you can see the whole process happening. But the whole process actually changes from one mango to a seed, to a tree, to a sapling, to a big tree, and now to a new mango. There's a connection all the way across. Just the same when you die, you have a stream of consciousness. For you it appears like your consciousness hasn't stopped. You're out of the body and you're still aware as you were before. Going towards a light, which is the nimitta in this meditation, going through the light, or if you really know about how to meditate, going into the light and staying there, and getting a rebirth. Because sometimes people can remember that whole process. But for you, it's just your consciousness just continues and you can't see much change at all. Dear Ajahn, when exactly does the stream of consciousness enter the womb, into the fetus, become a being? Great question, because that can happen any time after conception until just before the fetus is born. The fetus in a womb, according to Buddhism, has to have some consciousness to keep it going. If it's not the new consciousness from another life, it actually depends upon the mother's consciousness. So unless a new being actually enters that empty house called the fetus and displaces the mother's consciousness, the fetus is literally a part of the mother. And so, that's an interesting question, but the most important part of that question comes when we consider abortion. Because if a new stream of consciousness has not entered that sort of fetus, then it's not an abortion, you're not killing anything. It's just like taking off a tumour from the mother. But if the stream of consciousness has entered, that's a different being, and that is killing. And you need psychic powers to understand what's going on. So, it's a very difficult question, but that's actually what happens. It doesn't really help making the decision, but at least sometimes, when an abortion happens, you're not killing anything at all, because a new stream of consciousness has not entered. In the big picture, is there a God? You can actually find that. That's a sensitive question, so I don't want to upset anybody. But if I say yes, would you believe me? If I said no, would you believe me? So what do we actually mean by a God? If we mean like an omnipotent person, a being who's in control of you in every moment, that does not make sense. Simply because if there was such a being, and they were compassionate. They should have been around in the floods in Johor, in the tsunamis in Katrina, and when your child gets a cancer, there's so many suffering over there that something is going wrong there. So the old idea of a God you can always pray to and actually get your favors asked sometimes doesn't hold water. So instead of actually looking at a personal God, what most wise people do these days is actually to call God a principle. And I have lots of wonderful discussions with Catholics and Anglicans, the ones who are very intelligent and think and question, and to them that God is not a person, but God is a principle, like a first cause, like a love, like a force, like an energy, like a peace, like a freedom. And when we actually start talking about impersonal God, a principle rather than a thing, like a being, then we can have a lot of common ground between Buddhism and other religions. But if we come to be like a personal God, like a being, a creator, someone who's all-powerful, like the big boss in the sky, then that's where Buddhism just departs. Principle, Dhamma, yeah, a truth, but not a being. But if you don't agree with me, it's great to question and find out for yourself. And the only way you can really find out is actually by developing your mind so strong your mindfulness can actually investigate these things and find out for yourself what's going on. What is your take on cell memory? For example, the scar you personally have is a result of an injury in a past life. Yeah, that's, again, read Professor Ian Stevenson's books. He was a very interesting man, Professor Ian Stevenson. He started off as a GP, just an ordinary doctor in Virginia, in the west coast of the United States, so the east coast. And he was so good as a doctor, they invited him to come back to actually to teach. So he became a professor of medicine. He got bored with just ordinary medicine, his intellect was too strong. So he took a degree on psychiatry, and so became a clinical psychiatrist. He was so good, they invited him back into the University of Virginia to teach. So he became a professor of psychiatry. And one day, looking for a new research project, he decided, he heard of many people who claimed they could recall their previous lives. So he said, why don't we investigate this properly, according to honest scientific principles? And that's what he spent his life doing. He's written many books, and I said that, you know, he was visiting fellow of Magdalen College in Oxford. He was highly regarded by his peers. His methods were faultless. But now he's a very bitter man. He was still alive 1 or 2 years ago. The reason he's bitter is because very few people accept his research. Not because it's faulty in its method, but simply because its conclusions are too controversial. He's so disappointed that science is so dogmatic, it will not accept truth. It will just keep its old beliefs. They say it can't be true. And if you say it can't be true, that's not being scientific. It's not an open mind. You're judging it before you see the evidence. The evidence is there, strong, well-founded, proven. You just have to read it. But the funny thing, there's always a curious part. His research, you know who funded his research? What other corporation deserves to actually to fund research into reincarnation than Xerox Corporation, who does photocopies? They're the people who funded the research. The wife of the guy who funded, who was founded Xerox Corporation, was his main funder. From photocopying to reincarnation. Venerable sir, have you heard of breath works? Conscious connected breathing. I've remembered vaguely being in a room whilst doing breath works. Please. Yeah, I have heard of, like,
rebirthing and doing breath to actually to get back to previous lives. Sometimes that is real, sometimes it's not real. It's uncertain. Because you're not really getting strong enough mindfulness, you're not really going deep enough into your mind. So that's a bit uncertain, your memories of previous life, when you do breath work. But when you do this sort of meditation, that's powerful stuff, and that's sure, that's certain. But it's harder to do. The breath works is much easier to do, it doesn't take so much time. But the meditation takes time, but when you get those past memories, wow, they're great. This world is full of praise and blame. Even respected Buddha cannot avoid this. How do we know that blame or accusation is true? What is the criteria to take to avoid wrong judgment of an accusation? Again, someone calls you a dog, look at your tail. Look at your body. Sorry, look at your bottom. If you've got a tail, you're a dog. If you haven't got a tail, listen to what they say. And if what they say is true, say, thank you, sir, yes, I have acted like a dog. And if what they say is not true, then forget about it. I'm sorry, sir, you were wrong. I'm not stupid. Why do we always believe what other people say about us, instead of knowing it for ourselves? Someone calls you ugly, look in the mirror, make your own decision. Or get your family and have a vote. That's where I'm from. Does one's last thought affect one's rebirth? Good thought to good rebirth. Yeah, it does affect your rebirth. And those of you who want to find a quick way of making sure you get a good rebirth, listen to that talk I gave the other day of the man who called his three sons Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, so you could always keep them in mind at the time of his death. In the memory of a past early life, does one see as first person or second person? As first person. You're right inside your experience. You're not like looking at it from a distance. Actually, you're experiencing it. You're in the pram, not looking from outside. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please share your perspective on what's the difference between an expectation and a hope? Like, a hope has a bit of uncertainty. In other words, it may happen, it may not happen. And that's actually much closer to the truth, because you don't know what's going to happen. You hope it may happen, but also you take account of if it doesn't happen. That's one of the wonderful ways of actually stopping fear of the future. I read this first in that wonderful book on philosophy called Winnie the Pooh. And one day, Winnie the Pooh, this little bear, and his best friend, Piglet, were walking home from Rabbit's house back to their home. And they were walking through the forest when a storm started to grow. First, the wind was quite strong, but then it got stronger and fiercer, and first of all just leaves were coming down from the trees, and then branches, and then whole trees were coming down around them. And little Piglet got so afraid, he got so scared, he grabbed the paw of Winnie the Pooh so tightly and said, I can't go on, I'm so afraid. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And that was a real possibility. What would happen if a tree fell down when you were right underneath it? And for a second, Winnie the Pooh was afraid, but only for a second. And then he got his innate wisdom. His fear disappeared, and he told Piglet how to let go of fear. He told his little friend, he said, you just said, what would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? I say, what would happen if a tree did not fall when we were underneath it? If it didn't fall. And that's all they needed to carry on. Isn't fear always saying, what would happen if something terrible happens? And the opposite to fear is, what would happen if it didn't occur? What would happen if your cancer wasn't terminal? What would happen if the stock market didn't crash? What would happen if you didn't die? And actually, what would happen if it didn't is far more likely.
When we look upon the future, we always tend to see the worst possible scenario. That's why a few years ago I arrived at Singapore at Changi Airport to give a series of talks at Suntec City. The organization of Buddhist Fellowship had hired this expensive convention hall just for me, with about 5,000 seats or 3,000 seats. And as I arrived on the aircraft coming in, I was reading the Straits Times. In big black letters on the front page was, I think, 99 people died of SARS. And the government had closed all the schools. And there was advice from the Singapore government not to have any public meetings. So the organizers were waiting for me outside. And the first thing they said was, "Shall we cancel?" And I said, "I just read today 99 people have died. What's the population of Singapore?" And they said, "About 3 million. I said, "That means 2,999,901 people hadn't died. Why didn't they write that on the front page of the newspaper? So what's the chances of anyone dying? 3 million to 100, that's 30,000 to 1. That's pretty good odds, let's go for it." So we had our talks, and of course no one got SARS. But can you see the fear which comes up in people? What would happen if? And it's completely irrational. Your chances are very good. So that's actually the difference between hope and expectation. The hope is actually more rational. You know it might happen, it might not happen. Expectation is going to happen. I know it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Oh no. "May I know what is consciousness mean?" Thank you. Okay, if you're listening to me, you're conscious. If you're not listening, you're unconscious. "When one passed away, did you get reincarnated immediately? If not, where does this soul mind go before reincarnation?" You get reincarnated into the ghost realm or into the space in between for a while. It's great being a ghost because you can come and tell your friends. You can play around, have fun. It's wonderful being a ghost. Because all those people who cheated on you, you can go around and go, "You're not going to sleep tonight." You get your own back. You can find out if your wife really does love you. You can actually follow her around, see where she goes. Isn't it great being a ghost? You can go into those places you're usually forbidden. You can come and check me out. What does Ajahn Brahm do when he goes back to his room? Come on. Isn't it better to be reborn as an animal? If I'm reborn as a human being, firstly I need to go to school, study hard and pass exam. And after finishing studies, worry about looking for a job. After getting a job, fretting about waking early to go to work. If I'm reborn as an ant, for example, I don't need to study for exam. I can sleep in every day, all I need to do is just eat and sleep. Isn't it a much better life? No worries at all. People step on ants. They put pesticide all over you. Is that what you really want? I wouldn't be an ant. Oh no. If we keep going early and early in our previous lives, do we see our origin on time zero? Is this important for our cultivation? The Buddha said he remembered 91 eons of existence. That's 90 big bangs. That's actually in the suttas. This is actually how you know that the mind actually transcends the origin of this particular universe cycle. And being a theoretical physicist, I was really fascinated by that. And what I was really fascinated by, there was one way, the Buddha said, where you can actually calculate the age of an eon. And it comes from the saying that one day in the lowest deva realm is the equivalent to 100 years of human life. And those days was over 100 celestial years. So you can actually get their lifespan in terms of human years. And the next layer of heavenly beings, the Tarvatings realm, one day of their life is equivalent to 200 human years, and they live 200 celestial years. So every time it goes up by a factor of 4. And then you get to the Brahma realm, and in that realm it's supposed to last for the whole eon. So when the first I saw this, being like a bit of a physicist, a mathematician, I got my calculator out. And I did the sum, a very simple sum, to find out what is the age of an eon. And it came out about 39,000 million years. Now, as a scientist, that made sense, because most astronomers say that the time since the Big Bang is about 13,000 million. So the Buddha's saying is about a third of the way. Now that's in the ballpark. That actually is acceptable to science, that figure. Because he was saying from the beginning to the end, about 39,000 million. And we've done 13,000 million so far. That would be the sort of thing, figure you'd expect. So it's fascinating you have such figures there. Dear Bhante, is hypnosis, can it bring your past life? How can we alleviate the pains and sufferings and bad karma of our past life and this present life? Okay, the hypnosis can sometimes bring back your previous lives, but sometimes it's uncertain. But I've got a nice story about hypnosis I'm going to tell you now. There was this priest, when he took over his church, his sermons weren't all that inspiring, so only a few people came to listen. And when he put the collection plate around, he only got a few cents, not enough to pay the bills. And that went for a few weeks, and his church was actually in big financial problems. So he went to see the bishop. And you can change, this is where I heard, it's nothing about Christianity, you can change it to being a Buddhist monk. Let's change it to being a Buddhist monk. This new abbot of a temple, when he started giving his sermons, they were really boring. And so the donation box, after each sermon, had only a little bit of money in, not enough to pay the bills. So he went to see this chief reverend. Not our chief reverend, he has passed away. I don't want to sort of say he would do such a thing, like someone like me. And the chief reverend said, that happened to me when I first started out. And in order to encourage people to make good karma, this is what I did. When they came to listen to the weekly sermon, I turned off the aircon and made it a very warm room. And when I gave my sermon, I gave it in a monotone, very dull and very boring. And when everyone was about to fall asleep, I got out my watch, backwards and forwards, until everyone was hypnotized. And when they were hypnotized, I said, only 50 ringgit notes in the donation box. No 20s, no 10s, no coins. Only 50 ringgit notes, only 50 ringgit notes. And the new reverend said, I can't do that. That's fraud. And the chief reverend said, oh no, it's encouraging people to make good karma. Do it. So the next time there was a public talk, the new reverend, the young priest, turned up the heating, gave a very boring talk. When everyone was about to go to sleep, got out his clock, only 50 ringgit notes, nothing less. Have you got 100 ringgit notes? No, 50 is the highest. You get 100? Got 200? Okay, only 50s and hundreds, nothing less. And it worked a treat. Everyone was so hypnotized, and they never realized, they all stuffed the box with 50 ringgit and 100 ringgit notes. He made a fortune for his temple. And he paid off all the bills and had a lot spare, but he couldn't do that every week, because otherwise people would figure out there was something strange going on. So he waited. He waited until the next time that he needed some cash for his temple. And he did the same again, turned up the heater, gave a very boring sermon in a low monotone until everyone was almost falling fast asleep and they were ready to be hypnotized. And he got out his watch and started swinging it. But then something happened, he dropped his watch. And he forgot where he was and he said, shit. And it took them a week to clean up the pretty. And that is an example of making bad karma coming back to you. So that's my hypnosis joke. When a person who is satisfied by when a person who is satisfied by the doctor is brain dead and his organs are harvested, will he feel the pain? No, he'll feel the joy. Assuming his conscious hasn't left him. Actually, you ask doctors, and if you are fully dead, your organs can't be harvested. They have to harvest them just before you're clinically dead. But at that time, you don't feel a thing. So don't worry, you've already left the body, you just, last bit of consciousness is still happening. You won't feel any pain, but you'll feel so much happiness and joy that your organs are going to someone who needs them. And I haven't brought my bag down here, but I've got a card in my bag. I am an organ donor. So I'm very happy to give my organs. And so should you be. Because it's the last act of good karma. And don't think, oh, if you give your eye, you'll be born in heaven with glasses. If you give your eyes, the next life would have such beautiful eyes. You don't have to need glasses. If you give your heart will be just so amazing, you'll never get a heart attack. And I was going to say that if you give your liver, you'll have a really healthy liver no matter what you do, but that's no excuse to take alcohol. So it's karma. You can give those things. And for those of you who know someone who has to weekly or maybe two or three times a week go on dialysis, can't you help by giving your kidneys? You don't need them anymore, but they do. So please be an organ donor. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up this evening or tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, can you explain the mechanism of dying? Yeah, easy. Stop breathing, you're gone. And how do you maintain consciousness of that state? Actually, it's very easy to die. It's the stuff coming up to death. That's the hard part. All the pain and difficulty. Once you actually you go, it's very, very easy and very, very pleasant. It's actually pain-free. The time just after you die is the most beautiful, peaceful time of your life. So you've got something nice to look forward to. It's true. People remember that. So it's so nice to die. And when they have to come back into their body because they've got still duties to do, it's painful to come back. You don't want to come back. You're having a great time. So it happens despite you. And the consciousness continues just as it does now. You can't find any difference, which is why that some people, when they're dead, they don't realize they're dead. Because it feels pretty much the same. Oh, this is a brilliant question. What decides which realm you go to? You know, there's a heaven realm in Buddhism, there's a hell realm in Buddhism as well. And if you look upon those old paintings, you know, in those old temples, you see pots of boiling oil with these poor beings being boiled alive. You see them with forked prongs, you know, being stabbed. You know, according to the tradition, you have these razor trees. We have to climb up and get cut. My goodness, that is old hat. Torture has gone a long way since those days. So do they still torture people in the old ways? And how could anybody, any kind, compassionate, powerful being, send anybody to such a hell place? The answer to your question is, you send yourself to hell. And you make the hell according to how you feel you need to be punished. and you stay there as long as you think you need to stay there. Anyone who studied any psychology knows the need for punishment coming from the feeling of guilt is one of the biggest problems of human beings. We punish ourselves for faults which we've done because we don't know how to forgive ourselves. And if you've done some sort of act which was mean, selfish, hurt other people, if you don't learn forgiveness now, in this life, when you die, you will remember that and you will want to be punished. You will choose a hell, make it according to how you feel you should be punished, and you'll stay down there. You'll seek punishment and pain. The psychology of guilt and punishment, which you can see in this life, is amplified. And that's how hells happen. They described it like that because that's just how people imagine things in those days. But these days, you'll make a much more sophisticated hell for yourself if that's where you feel you belong. And all you need to stop going down to those hell realms is learn to forgive yourself, to let go, to learn from your mistakes, not punish them. And as soon as you let go and forgive and learn some compassion, the hell realms don't exist for you ever again. In Buddhism, the level of attainment called the stream winner means that you will never need to go to hell again. The lower realms are no longer available for you. And the reason why that happens is because you have enough understanding of non-self to forgive and let go. So a hell realm will be made by you, and you send yourself there, no one else, because you think you deserve to be punished. Is it advisable to undergo regression under the guidance of a trained psychologist specializing in regression techniques? What influence can he exert on his patient to say what he wants the patient to say? Yes, sometimes there is that transference and that wishful thinking, but that's why you've got to get, if you do that hypnosis, get a good one. And not someone who's just in it for the money, but a lot of times if it's regression, all they want to do is to find some reason of healing your unhappiness, your psychosis, or your addictions in this life. And if that's the case, it does not matter whether it's a real past life or not, as long as it stops the problem. That's useful. And a lot of recession psychologists or regression psychologists, that's their aim. They don't want to prove past lives. So they don't really care if it's accurate or not. All they really want is for your problem in this life to be healed by this method. And if it heals your problem, wonderful, fine. But if you really want to find out real past lives, meditation is the best way. The current hype is for all religions to come together and show brotherly love and tolerance to one and all. But this is incompatible with what is taught in their holy tomes, which is full of killings, bloodshed, and bloodbath. And what's more, inherently demonize others practicing different faiths. Do you think religions will ever come together to make this world a better place for all? And I think that what is important is the religious texts of the past. We realize that they are never to be regarded as absolute truth, not the word of God or the word of the ultimate being, because if that's the case, we are, as I said earlier, we are confusing the container with the contents and worshipping the container. The story I said a few days ago, the American soldiers flushing down a copy of the Quran down the toilet, and people thinking that you can't do that. As far as Buddhism is concerned, you can blow up the Buddha statues, destroy the temples, you can take the Buddhist books and urinate on them. But I would never allow anyone to urinate on peace, forgiveness, compassion, kindness, love. Because that's what I know as Buddhism, not the statues, not the books. The statues and books contain the teachings. But they're not the teachings, they're the containers, the contents are what's important. What do the books say? What do the teachers promote? What are they pointing at? Not the book, but the message. And when people begin to separate the container from the contents, then we won't try and destroy the contents of our religion. We won't allow forgiveness, compassion, kindness, questioning, discussion. Those are the things we worship, not the statues, not the books. And when people learn that, I think we can come together. We can come together to discuss and learn from each other. We don't always agree, and my goodness, it would be terrible if we'd always agree. If we always agree, there's no growth anymore. There's no debate, there's no going deeper. And I said, I think I've deliberately cultivated old friends from other religions, because their arguments, their discussions, their way of seeing things from a non-Buddhist perspective helps me grow in my understanding. So, I think it's a wonderful time. But the first thing with different religions, we have to trust each other first of all, and be friends, and have that trust and friendship enough to actually to argue, and to be understood that we agree on most things. What we're arguing about is only a small part. So the arguments and discussions and differences should never be seen as an attack on your personal beliefs, but more as an inquiry to find deeper meaning on both sides. But it's hard to get trust in today's world, because when we meet each other, and this is one of the problems of interfaith meetings, usually we just go superficially. We're very friendly, but very rarely do we sit down for long enough to argue, because we don't trust each other enough, and we think, I don't want to offend. Real friends can take offense, because our friendship is bigger. I always say that of all people in this world, religious leaders should be the hardest to offend. You can mock my religion, you can criticize me, you can say the Buddha's stupid, but of all people, a leader should say, oh, never mind, that's okay, I still love you. Ajahn Brahm, okay, that's that one. I'm not going to finish these questions. I just choose three more. Those who don't get the questions answered, I'm not going to answer this one, there's two together. Those who don't get those questions answered, in your next life I will answer your questions. Here we go. 1, 2, 3. How do you interpret sexual misconduct? Oh, that's a hot issue. How do you interpret sexual misconduct which is in the five precepts? Oh, a misconduct may not be considered as much in a society that condones polygamous relationships or free sex. Would it be more appropriate to think of it as sensual indulgence rather than sexual misconduct? You can understand what sexual misconduct is if it harms another person or harms yourself. If it's hurting, if it's abusive, if it creates problems and difficulties. Such, you know, that if it's abusive, if it's somebody who's not in their right mind, like drunk, and you have sex with them, that's taking advantage. Or if you're in a teacher-student relationship, then that's taking advantage to have sex with your students. Or if it's your boss and they're your worker, you shouldn't have sexual relationships there, because it's complicated by the issues of boss and workers, teacher-student. So those are things in the West anyway, which are certainly no-nos. You can't do that, you go to prison if you do things like that. And also the sexual abuse of minors, of kids, paedophilia. That hurts and harms for life those children who get sexually abused. Or even you're a dominant person and your partner is just so submissive. Be careful, because sometimes you just force them into some sexual arrangement, and that's not fair. So you can ask yourself, is it harming someone? Is it hurting somebody? And ask it honestly. And if it really is harming and hurting, in the long run and in the short term, that's sexual misconduct. Obviously in a marriage, you know, if it's consensual, there's no harm there. But you know, if it's not consensual, if it's rape, even within a marriage, it's harming and hurting somebody. So be careful there. How do you do? And a Merry Christmas. I have a son, 15-year-old, and he's very big size and fat with a very big tummy. He's a happy Buddha. My wife thinks that he is reborn from a previous realm where all the beings there have big tummies. I think her view is preposterous. What is your view? But sometimes that people are genetically programmed to have fat tummies, and sometimes they can't do much about that. So, you know, don't like look at people who are fat and just think, oh, they should exercise and they're being lazy and they should do something about their extra weight, because that is being discriminatory again. So I think we should be compassionate and encourage people actually to do the right thing. But sometimes people are fat and that's it. So, not you come from a previous realm, I'm not sure where you come from, the realm of the Teletubbies or whatever they're called. Last question. I often feel insecure when a relationship started after a few months, i.e. jealousy, a little worry what the future might hold, and due to that often the relationship can't last. I wonder why do I have this insecure feeling over a romantic relationship but not so much towards friendship. How do I overcome it? That's a really great question. Because sometimes in friendships we haven't got such an investment of our personal happiness. But a romance is something completely different. We get excited, we have a huge investment, and we can go to the high heaven realms or go into deep, deep pain. The stakes are high, and that's why you feel insecure. However, with experience you learn, sure you get hurt sometimes, but if you do get hurt and you just withdraw into yourself, I call that putting your heart into a concrete bunker. Sure, you've been hurt and you won't feel pain anymore, but you won't feel any happiness either. Now, part of life is learning to accept the pain, to go for it and see what happens. Because if you do get hurt and have pain, only then do you know how to love, to be compassionate and to care. Because it's the pain, the difficulties of life, I call those growing pains. That's where you learn. That's where you learn to be more careful and tender and sensitive in the future. Sure, it doesn't work the first time, but learn from it. And then learn how to keep the relationship going, be more sensitive. You learn from what happened. But you don't just learn from your mistakes. Remember, learn from your successes as well. When you had a wonderful day with your partner, why? What did you do? Repeat the successes. It's much more powerful to learn from them than to learn from all your mistakes. Because if you just remember your mistakes, what went wrong, that's where you get insecure. You think it's going to happen again. I know it's going to happen again. And then it does happen again. It all falls apart. So learn from your successes. And then you get encouraged. You know you can make it work because you have made it work. And you'll make it work again. It's a positive feedback. That's what works. So when you've gone out with someone and had a wonderful time, a wonderful week, why? What did you do? Learn from that and you'll repeat it. You'll get even more successful in your relationships. And as a monk, I say this, and it's important to me that you're happy together, because when you're not happy together, that's when you come to my room and you talk to me for hours and hours and hours and hours, and oh, I get so fed up. Pure selfishness. No, it's not. We all want you to be happy. And we know you won't all become monks and nuns. You're all living in the world, and you're all having your relationships. It's important for you in life to have a good friend. May you have a wonderful friend. May you learn to love each other unconditionally, be the best of friends, and also be the best of lovers. be kind and caring to each other, and that will make for a wonderful, happy society. So that's in this life, let alone in your next one. So thank you for listening, and thank you for learning how to remember your past lives. And the next talk to finish off my series of talks coming tomorrow is the funny talk, laughing all the way to Nirvana. And I did that because it's a Saturday night tomorrow, and I've got lots of competition to get people to come and listen to me tomorrow. So I have to make it an interesting, funny talk. Laughing all the way to Nirvana, coming tomorrow night, the last talk. Now we do the sharing of merits, and then we can all go home. Idam menyatinam hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idam menyatinam hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idam menyatinam hotu Sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. I'll see you tomorrow. Good night.